In today's episode,
it's when the first fractals of decision making start to form, and you have to be more explicit about who is responsible for what decisions, and you need to build process that improves velocity. And it's a very uncomfortable thing to have to do. So that's been a really interesting thing to work through. We actually coincidentally today had a team all hands talking about company stage and complexity and figuring out how to do some of these things. So that's probably the biggest update, is figuring out how to navigate that.
This week's episode is sponsored by AppSumo, the marketplace entrepreneurs trust to buy and sell products that grow small businesses into name brands. There's no better place for tools to help you build and grow your business. Whether you're a content creator, designer, or marketer, they're connected to some of the hottest tech companies, so you don't have to waste time searching for great stuff. AppSumo makes it easy for you to automate and boost your productivity so you can actually focus on your business. Sign up at AppSumo.com or hit the link in the description below. Sam Corcoros, how you doing, my man?
I'm doing A-okay.
Welcome to the show, man. I've had your co-founder, Josh, on the show before. And as people who are watching on YouTube can see, we've got Levels, the logo behind you, always representing. I love that. So we have done an episode on Levels before. And if you're interested in health tech and CGMs, continuous glucose monitor, all the metabolic health stuff, I would recommend, if you're listening to this, you could go back to that one and listen to that, because we did a whole deep dive with Josh. But today we're going to be doing kind of an update. It's now almost 2 years on, and the company has changed a lot. You've just raised your Series A, I believe, for $38 million. And yeah, we're going to talk all about growth and how you've taken the company to the next stage. But before we do that, I'd love to just paint a picture of you, because not only have you done this company, you've done multiple companies before. Could you give a little bit of a background on your past and how you landed up at Levels?
Yeah, this is my fourth company. It's the first one that's really reached this stage of growth. A lot of very hard lessons learned from previous companies. I've been in software for a long time. This is actually my first role, not as an engineer. And I took a year off work after Kardash, which was the last company I was involved with, and spent a lot of time thinking about what I wanted to work on. And I ended up having a good conversation with Josh. He's somebody that I'd known for years previously, and realized that CGMs and metabolic health is a very, very big problem. And Josh and I had a pretty early conversation, recognizing that we made a pretty good team, and that sometimes you just have to look at who's available and what their skill sets are. And we realized that my skill set was most suited for the role of CEO. And so I've been hitting the ground running since then. It's been a very different experience, I will say that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And we're going to go into kind of like the more tactical side of what that actually entails in the second half of the show. How did you and Josh actually meet? You said you knew each other for years, but where did you initially meet?
Yeah, I met his father at a conference. And I think I was giving a talk on something like cybersecurity. And we had a long conversation. And at some point he said, like, you know, you would really get along with my son who's at SpaceX. And so the next time I was in LA, I just stopped by and Josh and I hung out for a few hours and really connected very quickly, and stayed in touch probably a couple times a year for the next 3-4 years. And then he reached out to me on a new project that he was working on after SpaceX, related to glucose monitoring. And he was going down the path. He was thinking about building the next generation of glucose monitor. And the more we dug into it, we realized how bad that idea was and how incredibly hard it is to build medical device hardware. And that really, the hardware that exists today that is manufactured by the major manufacturers are Abbott and Dexcom is actually quite good. And the cost curve is coming down pretty quickly. And so the real value there is in the interpretation of the data and the contextualization layer, which is really what software solves. And that's what my background is in. So we started working together to figure out how we might go about solving that problem. And after just really just a couple of weeks of collaborating on some of these problems, we realized that there was a real market opportunity and that it was a really big problem that needed to be solved.
Yeah, completely. And so when I spoke to Josh originally, he kind of painted a similar picture to you, which was we initially thought the hardware was the problem. Once we dug in, we realized they actually worked pretty well. But like you said, you identified the cost is quite high, even now for a lot of people. If you're not getting it through insurance, you're paying out of pocket. It's quite a decent, you know, just I think you guys charge $200 a month, is it? For the sensors you guys have. So again, way less than it might have been 10 years ago, and incredible technology, which I'd love to actually just paint a picture in a second of what it actually looks like. But at the same time, like you said, the insights and interpreting that data is as important, if not more important, than just collecting the data, which is probably a bigger principle in general life, not just CGM.
For sure.
But let's talk a little bit about CGM specifically, just even a short version of it, in case someone hasn't come across them before. How exactly does a CGM or continuous glucose monitor work? I've used it. I use Levels right now. Could you explain like exactly what it is and how it collects the data?
Yeah, I'll get pretty specific on the underlying technology. If it's too specific, let me know.
No, I think that's good. I think people like to know exactly what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a filament. It's kind of like the it's most similar to fishing wire. Is if you were to feel it, it has that sort of feel. It's stiff but still flexible, which is, I don't know, less than a centimeter long, and it has a spring loaded cannula that pops that filament under the skin. You don't feel it, but it's there, and there's that little wire, and that wire is coated with an enzyme, which is glucose oxidase, which binds with glucose in your body. And the underlying technology is electrochemical, which is that filament can recognize the change in conductance that is caused by the enzyme binding to those glucose molecules. And it can recognize that binding that changes the electrical conductance of the filament. And it can measure that as a change in concentration. So it's able to use chemistry, electrochemistry is the underlying science behind it. And it's able to use that to determine the concentration of different molecules. And there are, interestingly, something that we're very excited about is there are a lot of efforts. Abbott has a new group, the BioWearables group, that's really focused on multi-molecule sensors. So being able to measure ketones and alcohol and other things in your body in real time as well. So I think we're going to see a lot of very interesting things happening in the space in the next, like, call it 5 years.
Got it. Yeah. And just to paint a picture, I realize I've actually got this on my desk. I've got like an old school way of doing which is like a finger prick. The Lancet. And I've got this device. And I used to do this a few years ago when I was trying to get my health in order. I'm not diabetic, though my dad is. I was trying to figure out, understand glucose levels and ketones as well. And I was always like, this just seems so stupid. Like, I'm having to do this, prick my finger. And it was always just, I'd heard of continuous glucose monitors, I think from Tim Ferriss originally. And it sounded like this amazing thing to try. And when I came across your product, I was like, okay, cool. This is something that is something I can just about afford, or, you know, like I can budget for it at least. And instead of doing it once a day or once every few days, it would be basically capturing it every, I think, is it 5 minutes or something like that?
Yeah, it depends on the manufacturer. Some of them are 5, I think some of them are 15, but it's pretty continuous, yeah.
Which is cool, yeah. And so just to paint a picture for people, that means you're going to basically see a graph of your glucose levels throughout the day. And then what Levels does is, you know, the way I'm describing it as a user, and you can correct me if you've got a better way of describing it. I take a picture of the food I'm eating. So I just had this big salad right now. I take a picture, and then over time, you're going to start to see how your body reacts to that different food, specifically with glucose monitoring. And so I think that's genius, and it's really helpful. I wish like the whole world had access to it, because it is, you know, really, really helpful, even just directionally, to understand the things that, you know, how your body reacts to things. I'm curious, from your point of view, since the last time we spoke with Josh, like, what are some interesting use cases that you might not have necessarily thought about people using it for? Or are there any stories of people that you saw that, oh, that's a cool use case, I didn't really even think about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because there are so many of them. We knew that this was a really big problem, but the more research that we've done and the more pieces our editorial team writes, I think we had all underestimated how many problems are ultimately caused by underlying metabolic dysfunction. Things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is the leading cause of infertility in women in the United States, is ultimately a metabolic condition. A lot of erectile dysfunction in men is caused by microvascular damage that is caused by underlying metabolic dysfunction. And like almost every chronic condition that people experience, almost every one of them has some significant link to underlying metabolic dysfunction, which is largely caused by diet and lifestyle. So,
got it.
Yeah, it ended up the categories of what we need to be thinking about ended up being much, much larger than we anticipated.
And that's the thing, right? So a lot of the time, and this is not necessarily because of a big evil government agency or, you know, big pharma, you know, some people have those sort of misconceptions. Sometimes it is, right? Like sometimes the healthcare industry does block things from becoming cheaper or whatever. Sometimes though, it's just the other side, which is it takes a long time to do these things. And as we've seen in the last couple of years, to test millions of people or billions of people, and understand how people are going to react to things takes time. But I guess the main thing I got from learning about your company was it's not just a diabetic problem, right? Like 50% of people are either diabetic or pre-diabetic or overweight, and eventually might become, you know, metabolically unfit or whatever we want to call it. I'd probably put myself in that bucket, to be very frank. So just to, I don't want to use too many technical terms, but just the word metabolic health, and we're not going to do a deep dive into this, but what exactly does metabolic health mean versus just, you know, what other people think of regular health?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think what most people will come to realize is that metabolic health is what most people mean when they say health. They just don't realize it. I had a conversation with somebody yesterday who was saying how the problem is not diabetes, it's obesity. And I had to explain that, like, both diabetes and obesity, neither of those are, they're not in a vacuum. They're actually both symptoms of the same underlying condition, which is underlying metabolic dysfunction. You can think of metabolic health as it is the way that your body metabolizes food into energy. It's how your mitochondria function. And this is such a, you could almost use it as a definition of what life is. Like, fungus have a metabolism. That is something that we share with almost all of these types of cells. And even in every type of organism, if the underlying mechanism by which they create energy from food is broken, you would expect that a lot of things downstream of that would also be broken. And so metabolic health is, it is that process by which your body creates energy from food.
Got it. Yeah, that's a great way to define it. And again, we're not going to go into the full health side today, but if anyone's interested and you're listening, and you guys have your own podcast, you've got a great blog about all this stuff, a newsletter. Another guy I'd recommend checking out is Dr. Peter Attia. He has really good stuff on this area, and just in general longevity, and a lot of this stuff kind of overlaps, right? It's about understanding the different factors that impact your health. So and one of the things I've learned kind of through his stuff is the difference between lifespan and health span, I think it is,
for sure.
And yeah, one is about quality of life, how well you live. The other one is about how long you live. because, you know, my background is in tech, as is yours. And in the tech world, it became a bit of a meme that, you know, these billionaire dudes are drinking blood of kids and stuff like that to like increase their life, you know, how long they're going to live. But in reality, I think what's even more important is how well you're living and the quality of life you actually have in that time. So again, I'd recommend listening to the first episode on that where we did a deep dive, and maybe we can transition to more on the business side. So since the last time we spoke, what has changed? It's or spoke to your company at least. What has changed? Because you just raised $38 million Series A. You're backed by Andreessen Horowitz, I believe, and some other great investors. Where could you paint a picture of what kind of size you're at now and the kind of stage of the company?
Yeah, we're just about to come out of closed beta. Our target is this summer, and I think we're on track for that for general availability. We've really been focused on building out the team, really also ensuring that our business model is aligned with the long-term health and well-being of our members. This is one of the things that we've been blocking launch until we know that we have that right. Because once you pick a business model, it's nearly impossible to change it. The only way you can change it really is to start a different company. Once you start in growth, it's very, very, very hard to change business model. So we're about 50 people now. I think last we spoke, we were probably closer to 10. And it's been really interesting. Over the last maybe 3 months, that sounds about right. Over the last 3 months, a lot of the systems and processes that we had have basically stopped working. It's an interesting phase. I would consider this the third phase change of company complexity. And a lot of the basic things like how decisions get made just kind of stop working, and how concepts end up on the roadmap just kind of stop working. And I've talked to a bunch of founders about this and companies that have scaled through this phase. And I was talking to one earlier this week their company is now at 800 people, and he described the 50 to 75% stage as the hardest transition in the history of their company. And it's because it's when the first fractals of decision-making start to form, and you have to be more explicit about who is responsible for what decisions, and you need to build process that improves velocity. And it's a very uncomfortable thing to have to do. So that's been a really interesting thing to work through. We actually coincidentally today had a team all hands talking about company stage and complexity and figuring out how to do some of these things. So that's probably the biggest update, is figuring out how to navigate that.
Yeah, especially I think you mentioned before that this is the first time you've gone from a technical role where maybe you led teams before, but I think even just going from even my background, individual contributor to team lead to leader of other leaders, and then and I was never technical, but from your point of view, going from technical to everything is I'm sure a huge learning curve as well.
Yeah.
And I think, is it Dunbar's number, is that
150? Yeah.
So Dunbar's number, that for people who've never heard of it, I think it's essentially the cognitive limit of number of people that you can know well or something like that. And I think a lot of founders I speak to, they hit, you know, even less than that a lot of the time, 50 to 100, or when you get to like 150, you no longer know everyone's name. And but I think what you're describing is like the complexity of like decision making and executing at the speed you were. And it's why, even for all the jokes we make about big companies, it's quite impressive that a company like Google or Facebook or whatever can still grow at the rate they are with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees. So we'll go into that a little bit more from the people side a little bit later. But could you also share, are you able to share anything on like number of users or revenue or anything that paints a picture on that side as well?
Yeah, so our revenue, I don't know, I think it's up, 300 or 400% from last year. I think we're doing something like a $10 million run rate. I think we're a little bit more than that, but roughly in terms of revenue.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, we've been really restricting growth while we're in closed beta to make sure that we get these cycles in and we continue to learn as much as we can. I think we've had roughly 25,000 people go through the program. So something in that range, in the tens of thousands. I think our wait list is about 200,000 now, something in that range.
Wow.
So,
yeah, the number I had when I first did research on your company was 22,000.
Oh, wow.
So that was, I think that was even before we spoke, because when I hear about a company that I'm interested in, I start like an Evernote note and write down the stuff. And that was probably the first time I heard of the number. So yeah, crazy that it's grown to that many now. So let's talk a little bit more about that membership model you talked about. So, to paint a picture where you are today or previously, people would be paying you guys $200 a month to get these, like, basically a month's worth of sensors and access to your app. And I think there was like an initial fee as well. I can't remember. Was that a couple hundred as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The core concept is we're still iterating on this, but the underlying goal is I want to make sure that we don't end up in a situation where our incentives are misaligned with the health of our members. I'm especially sensitive to this given my last company, which was in the car repair space, has such a problematic incentive structure where pricing is largely arbitrary. There's tremendous information asymmetry where you go to the mechanic, they tear apart your car, and they say, yeah, you need all these repairs, you need to drain your brake fluid, you need to do all these things, and if you don't, you're going to die. And you're like, oh man, well, I don't want to die. I don't want my car to be unsafe, so I guess I have to do all these things. And most of those repairs are actually unnecessary because those sales associates are compensated as a commission based on how much they can convince you that you need, even though much of it is unnecessary. And there's a reason why the car repair industry has such a bad reputation, and it's something that they've really earned. And it's bad in car repair. It is way worse if it's your health and it's health services. Telling people that you need to get rushed into a surgery that you don't need because they need to make their surgery quota, like, that is extra gross.
Yeah,
selling people medication. Yeah, like selling people medication, tests. It's the information asymmetry is so bad. So,
and it's often at a time where someone is in the worst place, right? Yeah. And you're in a rush. You don't have time to think. You don't have time to call your insurance and ask, hey, do you cover this?
Right.
And I've even heard stories of friends who go into a in-network hospital and then an out-of-network doctor happens to be serving them for some reason, and they get a crazy bill or something like that. So yeah, I completely get it. So just specifically to what you guys are doing though, were there scenarios that you thought through with an alternative, you know, membership model or alternative business model anyway, or pricing model, that you could say in this example, we would be charging someone for X and we're not happy with that decision?
Totally. Yeah. And that is what could happen if we charged a premium on, say, the sensors. The goal is the upfront cost. You mentioned the additional fee for the first month. That is the membership, which is we are basically capping the amount of revenue that we make per customer and saying, you are giving us $200 in profit. And now every interaction we have after this point is going to be as close to cost as we can. So if you buy sensors once a month, once a quarter, once a year, it doesn't really matter to us. If you want to do testing every week, twice a year, I want to be able to tell people that you should get these tests quarterly or whatever it is, because it's medically relevant, not because...
Oh, got it. Not because you're going to make a cut off that. Got you. Okay.
Yeah.
And I see this even in just on the regular, like, doctor side, like a lot of doctors are moving to this model of, instead of paying each time, you're just paying for the full year or something like that, and you gain access to them. So yeah, that's interesting. So just to be super clear, you got how much does it cost now with the membership model? And is that every year or is it just a one-off? How does that work?
Yeah, it's $200 a year for the membership. And this is also something that we're iterating on. We have active experiments that we're running to figure out what's the best approach there. So it's $200 a year. And then the sensors themselves, I think the current sensors that we work with, it's $200 a month for the sensors. So for most people, it's $400 for that first month. We're running some experiments with monthly pricing. We're running some experiments with quarterly sensors. But so we're running experiments with a lot of these things to really make sure that we understand it.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. And so on the sensor side, is there anything longer term that you think is going to ever bring these down in price? Because, you know, generally, as more people use things, there's economies of scale or whatever. And if that's the case, how far out is that? Because obviously for a lot of people, $200 a month is going to be, you know, kind of way too expensive for them.
Yeah, it's not far out at all. The Dexcom G7 is coming out very soon, and it's smaller, it's cheaper, it's more accurate. The Abbott Libre 3 is coming out very soon, which is, again, also smaller, faster, lighter, denser, cheaper. If you look at the cost curve of glucose monitors over the last 10 years, like they've come down more than an order of magnitude, and it will probably continue to go down. They're getting much, much better at manufacturing them at scale. So, yeah, the cost curve is already coming down very, very quickly.
Got it. All right. That's good news and good to hear. Cause again, I know from speaking to Josh, a lot of that is out of your hands. You're just essentially passing on the cost. I don't know if it's literally at cost or close, but
it's as close as we can get to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not, you're not necessarily incentivized again to just stick to one. You're going to be incentivized to basically get the best product at the best price. And so that makes sense to me. That makes a lot of sense. But as it relates to what you guys are doing, moving from, you know, like you said, closed beta to, you know, opening it up, like what does that process look like in terms of, you know, you're basically going from a niche, very niche product to trying to go more mainstream. And yeah, what are the sorts of things you're having to prepare to get to that stage?
Yeah, I think the biggest answer is a change in focus. So growth has very much been an afterthought for us. We don't have a very large growth team. It's been something that shows up pretty late in our weekly team all hands. It's way at the bottom of our investor updates. It's not a metric that we're optimizing for. So I think the biggest thing is really just a change in focus, which is we will now have targets that we're aiming for, and it was an interesting thing in a lot of our fundraise. People would ask, like, what's your CAC to LTV ratio? And the answer is like, we can give you some rough numbers, but we haven't really spent the time to calculate or optimize this because it's not actually relevant for us at our stage. But what we're really optimizing right now is around product development. And we want to get as many cycles in to iterate on product and learn from our members, and like maximizing the number of validated learnings is the stage that we're in right now. Later this year, once we're out of beta and we have growth targets, we're still going to have that focus on product, but sales and growth becomes much more of a priority. So that's the biggest change that I anticipate.
That makes sense. Yeah, and especially, I guess, as you raise Series A, the incentives for those people putting money in is there's an expectation of growth and hitting scale. I noticed you shared your investor update with me before we spoke. And one of the interesting things I noticed is that there was a transition from NPS score, Net Promoter Score, to a product market fit survey or something along those lines. And I had Rahul Vora on the show from Superhuman. And he's, you know, again, if you're interested in that concept, you can go back and listen to that episode if you're listening to this. And he described like a very methodical way of doing that survey for product market fit. So I'm curious, one, on like what yours looks like, and two, why a shift from NPS to product market fit survey?
Yeah, I mean, ours is a direct copy of that methodology. So
it's not broke. You don't need to fix it. Yeah.
Yeah. What was interesting is Scott, our head of product, wrote up a proposal for why we should move away from NPS and towards PMF. And it led to some really interesting generative conversations. And what he proposed actually didn't fully end up getting implemented, because he was proposing we shouldn't measure NPS and that it's not relevant for us at our stage. And what I think we concluded after a bunch of us thought more about it is that certain metrics are relevant to different parts of the business. And what I think really came out of that exploration was we had been using NPS in our product org to understand how effective our product was. But NPS is actually a growth metric. And so we were using it improperly. And that's what had led to some misunderstanding in terms of what we were prioritizing, and that we needed other metrics to help our product org make better products. So that was an interesting recognition that Net Promoter Score is the number of people who want to, who tell other people about your product. And ours has been pretty high for quite a long time. It's been over 60 most months. And the concept that we have around building an NPS unicorn, which is building a product that has an NPS over 90, which is really, really hard and has never been done in healthcare before, really could make this a viral growth engine that makes it basically unstoppable. And recognizing that it really applies strongly to growth, but not nearly as much to product, was a big learning for us.
Well, and I guess as you're moving into this next stage where growth is a bigger part of the agenda, then it might be more relevant again, right? That's interesting. And to hone in on the product market fit approach versus the NPS, what are the things you're looking for there? Because I know with Rahul, they were looking for the right feedback from the right people, and he basically disregarded feedback from people who weren't there for the core need, or I forgot the exact terminology. Mm-hmm. And for Superhuman, it was people who valued like having the fastest email or something like along those lines. So what is that kind of core kind of value for you guys, and how does that compare to other segments of your user base?
Yeah, I think the biggest insight that people take from Rahul's piece on product market fit is what most people do, which is incorrect, is they get a bunch of feedback and their critics are going to be the loudest, and they end up building a product to satisfy the people who dislike their product.
Yeah.
And they basically disregard all the people who like the product, and they end up building something that is in the opposite direction of where they should be going. And what he talks about in the piece is you should be doing the opposite. Like, figure out who your biggest advocates are and fire your worst customers. And like, just continue to double down on the people who get it and who like it, and find more of those people. And so for us, it's about this is one of the challenges of building a product in the healthcare space that applies to basically anybody who eats food. Yeah, it's like when we first did
a broad target, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyone who eats food, yeah.
When we did our first personas investigation, I think we ended up with 15 or 16 very distinct personas that are all extremely large markets. And trying to narrow in on like which one do we focus on? It's really hard. Like a woman in her 50s going through menopause and all the hormonal changes and how diet affects you is very different from the 26-year-old biohacker marathon runner male who's trying to do this to like eke out some extra performance. Those are very, very different products.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. And so figuring out how to thread that needle has been an interesting challenge. So
with those, but that's a great example. Those two contrasting people, it really paints a picture of like, I can see both those people using your product, but asking for different features. And I think even more importantly with you guys, because even though you're a software company, you're interacting with hardware, and there's certain things you can't change about the hardware, right? And with Superhuman, it's a little bit easier because it's just software, and they can just, you know, disregard the stuff that isn't as useful or relevant. And so when you guys did that persona sort of exploration, what were those personas that you guys ended up honing in on out of the 16 or whatever it was?
Yeah, it's something that we're actually writing about right now. We're going through an exercise of writing out OKRs, which is funny because we did this about a year ago, and I think we were too small at that point because the OKR process didn't really add any value. But I think we are now that we're about 50 people, at a point where OKRs will be helpful again. So,
got it. We're working on that right now still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we have to solve as a company is we have to figure out, Moz, who runs business for us. He came from Apple, and one of the things that he mentioned that Apple does really well is you have to figure out how to cross the chasm without alienating your most vocal and evangelical users. So, like, the people who love the product the most are the biohacker types. Now, how do you build a product for the people on the other side of the chasm that are less sophisticated without alienating those people? And that's a difficult challenge. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to abandon your early adopters in order to cross the chasm. Yeah. But the best products are the ones that are able to bridge that gap without alienating them.
It's like the power user mode versus light mode or something like that. So I feel like lot of products even have those two distinctions for that reason. That's very interesting. I didn't think of it like that. So let's talk a little bit about growing. You know, you're now getting to a growth stage. You're about to launch in the next few months, at least, out of beta. And again, from your investor update, I could see, you know, you guys are thinking quite strategically about growth and partnerships and the things you're going to do to get this out to more people. And the two things that really stood out to me, which I'd love to go into a little bit more, is one, partnerships, and two, 10xing your digital content, which I saw was its own category in your write-up. So Matt, why don't we start with 10xing content, because I feel like partnerships is kind of, you know, related to that. It's more of an extension almost of that. So why the focus on, you know, digital content? Obviously there's many things you could be doing. You could be double downing on, you know, paid ads. You could be doing, you know, TV and commercials and all that sort of stuff, sponsoring marathons, you know, all that sort of stuff. So, like, why is it digital content and organic content, it sounds like, less so than paid? So why is that the first pillar for you guys?
Yeah, we haven't really done much. I don't know if we've, other than the very, very early days to get initial users that we could talk to, I don't think we spent more than a few thousand dollars on Google and Facebook ads. We don't really do them. And the reason is that you don't want to play the CAC to LTV game. Like, once you're in that, if you don't own your own channel and you're at the whim of whatever the current cost of running an ad is, it's really, really tough. And so the hardest thing to do is to own your own channel and to build your own content vertical that brings people in, that owns SEO, that owns distribution. And so sometimes you just have to do things the hard way. Yeah. And if you can do it that way, then it's like, I've had people ask, like, we have a very high talent team, and it's been a really intentional part of our strategy. And people ask, like, how did you do that? And the answer is, well, you put in a tremendous amount of effort, and then you continue to only hire extremely high talent people. And, like, be prepared to interview 100 people per executive hire that you make. It really does take that amount of time to make some of these hires. So I think as it relates to why we chose to go the content path is that competing for 3 or 4 seconds of attention. This was a conversation that Ben, our head of growth, had with Nick Sharma. And he talks about how paid marketing and performance marketing is sort of like cold water, and everything else that you do of like earned media, owned media, that's all the hot water. And you can blend in some cold water here and there, but like you can't do too much of it. Otherwise you lose the ability to own that channel.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. With spring in the air, it's time for renewal and growth, personally and professionally. As your small business grows, LinkedIn Jobs is here to make it easier to find people you want to talk to faster and for free. Here's how to get started. In a few minutes, create a free job post on LinkedIn Jobs and you'll tap into the world's largest professional network. Then add your job and the purple hashtag hiring frame to your profile to spread the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people. Use simple tools like screening questions to make it easy to focus on candidates with the right skills so you can prioritize who you'd like to interview and hire. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs the number one place in delivering high quality hires versus their competitors. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates you want to talk to faster, and you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/creator. Again, that's linkedin.com/creator to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Now let's get straight back to the show. That's I'm just thinking out loud here, and I'll just say I definitely agree that it is, if especially at your stage before you're even out of beta, it definitely doesn't make sense. The only counterpoint to that I would say is when it does get to a certain point where your own channels, like once you've got that foundation of own channels, you know, paid can obviously be like the accelerant or the kind of fuel on the fire. And so I think that, and I know Lenny, I think Lenny is one of your investors or close to you guys anyway. I actually did an episode with him on a growth framework that is for later stage. So again, if you're listening to this and interested in that concept, you can listen to that episode. And I will say, so my background is in marketing and growth, and a big part of that obviously is paid, but I completely agree. Like when you, I've worked with startups that from day one, they're looking at paid and they haven't even figured out like product market fit, that if they've got a product which has product market fit and understanding who those core users are, like you said, the personas, if I was crafting a Facebook, Google ad strategy for you, you could target 16 personas, but really you want to target one or two, the most high value. And so I think that's a better way to think of it. Interesting. So on the digital content side, what does 10x in digital content mean for you guys? I know you've got your blog and a podcast as well. So is that just putting out more content? Is it, you know, yeah, I'm curious what that looks like.
Yeah, we do one of the things that we have that most people, maybe not most, many people on our leadership team, and I think it will be more and more over time, we have this routine of doing a think week where they take a week off of work. They're not checking email and they just think deeply about something and usually write up a long memo on that topic. And the challenge that I gave to Ben is just doing the thought exercise of what would it take? We're already producing a lot of content. What would it take working backwards from what if we 10x from where we are today? What would we have to do differently about our process to, like, given the same number of resources that we have today, if we were to 10x the amount that we produced, how would we have to rethink the problems that we're solving? And sometimes when you think in those terms of step functions, it forces you to consider different approaches that you wouldn't have otherwise considered. And sometimes the answer you come back with is like, kind of can't.
Yeah.
Like one of the things that we, like Mike Haney, our editorial director, had a similar challenge of how do you scale editorial? And the answer was like, look, if we intend to continue to produce really deep thought leadership pieces on metabolic health, the only way you scale this to 10x is you just have to spend a lot more money and hire people to write these pieces, because there's no shortcut to having.
And those are deep pieces, right? It's not like five deep things like BuzzFeed style, right? Five things that make you healthy. It's like real deep.
That's right.
Probably better for SEO long form content. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then, and so as it relates specifically to like the podcast, which I'm a fan of podcasts, Why did you guys choose podcasting as an own property? Because a lot of people don't actually, like a lot of people at your level would say, oh, I really value podcasts, but there's a limit to how many people can listen. And, you know, growing a podcast is very difficult. So I'm curious, like, what made you guys choose that channel?
Yeah, the podcast one is interesting because our podcast effort actually started. I had a conversation with Zach Cantor, who started Steady, and he's a very deep thinker on organizational design. And one of the things that I asked him is like, what are some things that you wish you could do about company culture? He said, you know, if I could do it again, I would have very early on, I would have started an internal company podcast, something where we produce our own content to get alignment. And so our company podcast, A Whole New Level, is actually the main audience is us, it's internal. Yeah. And I think 80% of our team listens to almost every episode on our podcast. So the goal is actually, it's to bring cohesion internally around how we emphasize culture, who the people are on the team. We do a lot of just like casual conversations, like Mike Haney, our editorial director, interviewed Jeremy, one of our early engineers, just like, who are you? I want to get to know you better, and learning about his history. And so it's been interesting because we've tried a lot of different formats, and we found that the more specific the topics are to our situation, the higher the engagement is. Like, people really want to know what's going on inside the company. Yeah. And so like I had one of our most popular podcasts is one where Josh, my co-founder, and I had a conversation about co-founder dynamics and some of the very tense conversations that we've had in company history. And Josh was really like authentic and vulnerable about some of his own insecurities and challenges working with me as a co-founder. And like having that available on the internet for people to understand how decisions get made and how we navigate these things has really brought a lot of authenticity and value.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I actually know that, and it makes a lot of sense. I've seen a lot more companies thinking about creating internal podcasts or creating them, especially like much bigger companies, like I think Google and Facebook, those size companies. It makes so much sense. Like, I was at Google for a long time, and we would get an email every week about like the 100 things we needed to learn that week, changing the product and all this sort of stuff, and memos from different people. And then you'd have like TGIF, which was the weekly, all hands with Larry and Sergey and Eric Schmidt back in the day. And they would have different teams come up and present. And that was actually really, like, I enjoyed that a lot, even not being in Mountain View most of the time. But most people just didn't even get to listen to it, right? And now, if you think, because that's like a video, and you're going to be sitting there for an hour watching it, versus what a lot of us do nowadays is listen to stuff while we're going for a walk or, you know, doing whatever else. So that makes a lot of sense. And I would say the metric that people kind of undervalue, and the reason I've been so bullish on podcasts for many years now, is depth of engagement versus breadth. And they're both important, right? Like, views and number of downloads is the metric here for podcasts. But what's more important is why I've actually moved a lot of my, I've got a second podcast where we've pushed more on YouTube. And that is like watch time and depth of that engagement, because that is really, you know, if someone is listens to you for an hour a week, it's very different to them reading, you know, a tweet from you or something like that. And both have their own pros and cons. But I think that's something that doesn't really get measured properly a lot of the time, because we're just so used to this views model. And as it relates to kind of like podcasts as a whole, you know, the incentive misalignment there is, you still get paid on number of downloads, right? So that's kind of how the existing model works. Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about partnerships then, because that is another way you can scale your own content or your own messages. So how have you guys been thinking about that? I know you've partnered with David Sinclair, Mark Hyman, two very prominent people in the health space. And there's some others which we can't mention names just yet, but some very exciting names coming down the road. How have you guys thought about partnering with the right people, and what does that look like for you guys?
Yeah, I think Partnerships are incredibly important for many reasons. The biggest one is, I would say, is social proof, which is the getting the, this is one of the challenges that I think we face in today's landscape, where the social proof that really mattered to people 10 years ago was if the New York Times said that you're credible. But the trust in institutions has been declining a lot over the last probably 10 plus years. And so trust in individuals who are highly specialized has increased. Like Peter Attia, who you mentioned earlier, is a great example of somebody where he's really built up a lot of authentic trust with the people that he engages with. And he's very thoughtful and credible. We've gained a lot of inspiration from his work. And getting those people who have built trust over many, many, many years, those are the people who, getting them on your team and bringing along that credibility is super important. So it's way more important than just getting conversions. It's getting those people to authentically buy in. And this is one of the interesting things that Tom, our head of partnerships, we have a affiliate strategy. And one of the things that he has in there that's controversial, but I think in retrospect is absolutely the right move, is that we won't work with people who we do not believe authentically understands what we're doing and is promoting it from like a truthful place. We've had a lot of very high profile people who want to promote our product, and they don't use the product. They don't really even know what it is, but they can read a script. And we don't really engage with those people because it misses the point of why we have these relationships to begin with. So
yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's beyond just distribution. Obviously, distribution is part of it, but it starts from that level of truth. I think especially in health, that is really key. So that's great to hear. And then you mentioned the affiliate model there, or part. So in a traditional business, you'd have, you know, affiliate or influencers, something like that, as your line item in a spreadsheet, right, in a marketing plan or something like that. Is it as simple as, you know, you sponsor their podcast, you sponsor their newsletter, come up with some sort of plan to promote stuff like that? Or how does that look like to you guys?
Yeah, I would say I think of it more as a brand building exercise than it is a conversion exercise.
Got it.
So it's still within the marketing budget, but it's, I think, a different line item in my mind.
That makes sense. Yeah, completely. Awesome, man. Well, I did want to transition a little bit to you operating the company and that transition you've gone through. You mentioned earlier that you were a technical founder before you were CTO, and you've transitioned into working across the board in many different, you know, wearing many different hats, essentially. What's that transition been like for you? Because, what are some of the things you've really struggled with adapting to? Because a lot of people never get to that stage where they feel comfortable being a full-time CEO.
Yeah, it's been an interesting transition. And it's my role is constantly evolving. It took me a while to get comfortable letting go of the code base and not being involved. I haven't written substantive code in more than a year now. And that took a while to really get comfortable just letting it go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's now at the point where it would take me significant time to be able to ramp up and start contributing again. And so I might never end up contributing again to our code base, which is kind of a weird feeling. A lot more of my time is on people management. I think that it's a lot more now than it was even 3 months ago, because we're basically re-architecting our entire organizational structure. And so I imagine in 3 months, it's going to be a lot less of people management and hopefully a lot more on strategy. So my role goes in these crazy waves of like jumping in and taking major responsibility for a functional area for some period of time until we find the right person to fill that role. And then I go on and do something else, and it's totally unpredictable what that's going to be. So it's been a very, very interesting thing. I think as a CEO of an early stage company, you kind of have to be 80% good at every possible thing that a company would need.
When you say 80% good, you mean you're never getting to 100% of being the best in the company, but you know enough, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like we had to make some decisions around how we account for revenue recognition. And I know enough to know how a balance sheet works and how an income statement works to be able to say, we need to do it this way since we're doing accrual-based accounting. But I'm not an accountant. And at some point, I knew when my limit was and said, all right, we now need to bring on somebody internal who can actually do this correctly. I am not a lawyer, but I can read FDA guidance and get us to a point where I'm highly confident that we are doing this correctly, and we can talk to outside counsel and get validation for it. But then you get to that point where it's like, okay, these things are now getting really complex. We need to bring on an in-house counsel who knows a lot more about this than I do. And so it's about getting to the point where you can solve problems and knowing when you're out of your depth and you need to bring on somebody who's better than you to solve those problems.
I love it. And this is a perfect segue into an amazing piece you wrote on First Round about the exact categories of time you spend on the work that you do. And I'm going to share my screen in a second to show a couple of the kind of visuals for people that are actually watching this, and for people only listening, which is most people, I'll try to describe it for you. And just before I do that, I do want to share my general principle. People have probably heard this over time, is like, I think productivity, being effective worker, is very important, but it can also become a huge distraction for people where they really focus on finding the best tool and, you know, optimizing every single little thing. So in my opinion, like, the first thing is really setting your priorities and making sure you're focusing on the right things. But this level of detail is super useful when you're actually, you know, on a track doing real work, doing productive work. So I'm going to share my screen, and I'll share the link to this blog post in the show notes as well. Can you see that, Sam? Great. So yeah, and for people who are only listening, this is basically like a pie chart, or, you know, some form of that chart, which breaks down every single category from engineering, information processing, recruiting, reading, team, strategy, etc. And so you can see it's a pretty diversified chart. There's a lot of things going on here. But more importantly, I want to show you this one, which is the expectation versus reality, which I thought was very interesting. And I want to hone into these three different areas. So you had expected you'd spend 20% of your time on recruiting, 20% of your time on strategy, and both of those, you actually spent 3 and 5% on that from your calendar. And you, from what I read, you basically tracked everything in your calendar and tagged it, and you were using a piece of software that helped you as well. And then on the flip side, there was network, the category of network or networking, I guess, where you expected it would take up 10% of your time, but it really took up basically a third of your time. So I'd love to go into a few of those, because I think that's really interesting insight. Because, well, the first question I have is, was that the right mix for you? Or did you look at that and reflect and say, actually, I shouldn't be spending a third of my time on network? Just curious how that kind of landed for you.
Yeah, it was very interesting and surprising. I think what it came down to is the nice thing about measuring things is it can hold you accountable to your own goals. And you're absolutely right that knowing what's important in prioritization is the first thing that needs to be solved. There's nothing worse than spending time on something that should not have been started to begin with. And I think the biggest one was around recruiting. That wasn't the biggest surprise for me, because I felt like I was spending a lot of my time on recruiting, like a lot of my time. And when I actually did the math on how much time I was spending on it, it was way less than I anticipated. And it was actually in doing that analysis that I started budgeting more of my time to recruiting It still isn't as high as I think it should be. I think it should be at least 10%, but it's now more than it was previously because it's such an important, it's potentially the only actual responsibility that a CEO has is to build the right team. And so the rest of it is strategy, but in theory, you can hire the right person who's better at strategy, and then you don't need to do strategy yourself. So
yeah, what's that? There's a famous saying, I forgot who said it, but it was like three things a CEO does is set the vision, make sure there's money in the bank, and hire the right people. So, but again, you're right. Like even getting, make sure you got enough money in the bank, that could be a salesperson or a fundraising person or whatever. So you're right. Like at a certain point, it is all about just the people beyond yourself.
Right.
Very interesting. And so just to clarify, to be specific, when you say recruiting, is that literally just time doing interviews, reading CVs, like stuff like that?
Yeah. And reaching out to people and figuring out what candidates we should be talking to. Anything, any time that is spent writing documentation or talking to people or anything related to building the team. I even count like, some of the internal podcasts that we do, which are really for recruiting purposes, I'll even count that towards recruiting time.
Oh,
and even with those included, it's still a very small percentage of my time.
And so what was the biggest category? It ended up being, I'm just pulling that up here. It was network was the biggest one, and you thought it was 10%. So again, to be specific with network, what exactly does that include? And did you reflect on this and say, actually, I'm spending way too much time on this?
Yeah, that was an interesting one because I think I should be spending a lot of time on network because that is one of the things that fits in the category of things that only I can do that no one else on the team can do. It's nobody else can build my network as a leader. And what was interesting was really how it was really just how it felt, which was, I didn't think that I actually spent that much time on it. And I think it's because it's not emotionally exhausting in the same way. Like you can just visually imagine like spending all day on back-to-back interviews. That's not fun, but like meeting up with interesting people and talking about interesting topics, I could do that all day. It's fun. It's energizing. And so it was a recognition that certain types of activities are really draining for me in a way that that I had not previously recognized.
And I literally wrote a note when you were saying this earlier to ask you about this. So this was something I thought when I read this too, which was I do something similar, but nowhere near at this level, which I'd love to do at some point, is I kind of reflect normally on a quarterly basis. I used to do it like on a weekly basis when I would look at the, when I had a lot more to do, to be frank, I had a full-time job and stuff. But and I would kind of look at it and I'd see the week and I'd say, okay, am I spending way too much time on certain things? What are the things that gave me energy and what drained my energy? And when you said it felt like it was taking 10% of my time or more, that to me felt like, well, that maybe is a part that you didn't enjoy as much or the it was draining because you're having to go through back-to-back meetings, like you said. Whereas the networking part, you, like you said, you enjoyed it. So it was just natural for you to be able to go and do that. And I think regardless if you're listening to this, you're a CEO or not, this is applicable to everything, which is if you can find out the, if you can reflect on the things that give you that energy and somehow manage to create a life or a business or whatever that makes the most of those parts, your week to week is so much better. And that's kind of what I've tried to do over the last few years with the podcast is I knew I could speak all day to interesting people. So I was like, how do I fill my time with more of that? But yeah, there's always things you don't want to do. And I'm not a CEO of a, you know, of level. So it's a very different scenario here. The other thing I wanted to make this quite actionable for people is, I'll link to the blog post because I think it's worth reading through fully. You've mentioned there's a spreadsheet template in there which people can download and do this for themselves. I think you said like you download your calendar and you can take all your tasks or something like that. And do you manually tag them or something? Is that
I actually, I have an EA that does it sort of behind the scenes.
That was helpful, yeah, for sure. And so if you're doing it yourself or you've got someone to help, that would be cool. The other thing, you mentioned Rescue Time. Is that something you still use? What is Rescue Time and how do you use it?
Yeah, Rescue Time is something I still use. It's not something that I use as much anymore, but it still gives me like a weekly recap to just give me a general understanding of what I'm spending my time on. Like, it'll tell me how much time I spent in Superhuman versus Zoom versus whatever tool I'm spending time on. So it's a useful weekly data point of, like if I see that I spent a lot of time on Zoom and very little time in Notion, it means I'm probably not doing a lot of writing that week.
Got it. Yeah, that's helpful. So it's another kind of indicator, but not the full broken down thing, which you need as well. And then I just wanted to call out a few tactical things, which I think is quite interesting to discuss. One was ditch your to-do list, use calendar as a to-do list instead. Could you explain that a little bit more? Why use a calendar versus to-do list?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest reason is that there's one particular person that comes to mind, and I won't name him because I don't want to shame him about this. But
Josh, no, I'm joking.
he has a to-do list that probably contains five lifetimes of work. It causes him tremendous anxiety having all of these things that he wants to do. And he complains every time I talk to him, like, I just don't have enough time to do all these things. And it's like, yeah, you're right. You don't. Like, you literally can't do all of these things. And like you don't have a time problem. You have the same amount of time as everybody else. You have a prioritization problem. Like, you can't build a Burning Man art car and start a company and like raise a family and do all these things that you want to do. There's literally not enough time to do those things. And so the nice thing about a calendar is that it forces blocking things off on your calendar, forces you to confront that reality. It's really easy to say I'll have it to you by Friday. And you can say that about everything. And then Friday rolls around and you didn't do any of those things. And you're like, how did that happen? It's like, well, each of those things that you committed to takes 2 days and you committed to 10 things. So you committed to 20 days of work in 5 days. If that's on your calendar, you can see that very explicitly and it forces you to make those trade-offs. So it's really about using a tool that works within the constraint, which is time.
Completely. No, I love that. And so... We're doing another episode with Tiago Forte, who's the second brain king, and like, you know, he's all about this life. So we'll talk more about his process if you're interested in that in another episode. The other thing I would say is, again, that works for you, and I think ultimately, if it works for you, then it works for you, and that's the most important thing. It should be simple. I'm just going to share this. This is a little cliche by this point, but there's something called the Eisenhower decision matrix. You've probably come across it before. So again, if you're listening to this only and not watching, there's four buckets here, which is two axes. One is urgent, not urgent. And on the left-hand side, it says important, not important. Bottom left, if it's not important and urgent, you have to delegate to someone. If it's important and urgent, you do it right now. Not urgent and important, you decide. Not important and not urgent, you delete it essentially. And again, just search for Eisenhower matrix if that was too confusing to listen to. And I found that I don't do this. I need to do a better job of this myself, but I found that the way I actually do things is I have like an inbox. I use a tool called Things, which is just a to-do list app, but I then have those categories of, you know, the most important things, and then I basically drag them onto my calendar as well. So I kind of need to do both for me, because I've got a lot of, like, I put everything there, like my personal stuff, and some of that stuff I can put off for a few weeks. So I'm just curious, like, with you, when you need to push things out, how do you deal with that? Is it literally you go into your calendar and you go 2 weeks ahead or something like that?
Yeah, I move things around in my calendar. I think one of the recommendations would be try not to pre-schedule more than 50% of a given day, because you need slack in the system, because things do come up a bad situation that people will find themselves in if they're really trying to optimize every minute of every day is something comes up that takes up half a day, and now they have this cascading problem where, like, you missed half a day and now you're 3 weeks behind because everything had to get pushed, and now you're just way behind on everything. I think the Eisenhower matrix is a really important one, and this is my own experience, and from a lot of the founders that I've talked to who are working through this stuff, I would say that maybe 80 to 90% of the most important things for the success of your company fit into the important but not urgent category. And it is universally the most neglected category of work, because things that seem urgent always come up. And you can always rationalize why you have to do this thing now and why it's urgent, but there are very few urgent things. And it's hard to gain that perspective and to zoom out and to realize.
So what qualifies as urgent for you? Because I think that's a really good point. How do you actually say, and I think in previous roles, I've been like externally facing, and if anyone, like a partner, emails and says your team messed up, or, you know, I need you to guys to do this, that kind of like alarm makes it urgent, when in reality it needs to be urgent on my terms, not someone else's terms.
That's right.
So how do you think about what is actually urgent? How do you prioritize those things?
Yeah, the short answer is that it's extremely hard and takes a lot of practice and experience. A lot of things will seem urgent, like you have to respond to them. And I was going through with Ms., our head of ops, I was going through my email inbox and my calendar, and I went through 100 messages that I had received and had sent, and zero out of those 100 were time sensitive. And it's really about just setting clear boundaries around these things. Some of it is honestly just as simple as setting expectations of, like,
definitely, yeah.
It's like, great, thanks for that note, I'll get back to you by the end of next week. And they'll say, okay, no problem. You don't necessarily need to assume that you need to drop everything and do it right now. Most of these things are not as urgent as people think they are. And I think it really just comes with experience, where, especially first-time founders, every small opportunity feels like it's your big break. And so you have to take advantage of it now. I'm reminded of a recent founder that I had a call with, where they had this interesting opportunity with a partner, and they were going to drop their entire product roadmap to try to make it work for this person. And I said, like, look, you didn't even know that this opportunity existed until you got this email. Like, you now have this weird attachment to this thing that I have news for you is, first of all, probably not going to work out, because most of them don't, and that's fine. And it's also highly specific, and it's completely different than your product roadmap. Like, how's your strategy fundamentally changed because of this conversation? Or are you chasing the new shiny object that's going to pull you off of your objective?
Yeah, which is very difficult nowadays, for sure. That is really, really helpful. Thanks for sharing that. And again, I'll share in the show notes. You can click through and read the full write-up, but I tried to take out the most interesting things to me anyway. And the last question I had on kind of the way your company kind of functions, and as it relates to your actual day-to-day, week-to-week work, is I saw your investor, you know, update was in Notion. And it sounds like, you know, you mentioned earlier, you give people a week to go and think and write a memo. And a lot of the companies I've worked with on the startup side, they've now got, especially in a remote first world, a huge writing culture. And they don't always get it perfectly right, but I'm seeing that as a bigger trend, even more so than when I've worked in companies in the past. So curious, like, what does that look like for your company? And what, you know, I mentioned Notion there, but what else are you using to really collect that collective knowledge of the company and keep things in order?
Yeah, writing is an extremely important part of our culture. Deep, long form written content. It really helps build confidence and trust in decision making. We've been using Notion for a long time. We're a little bit biased. My brother was actually the first engineer at Notion.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, we've been using Notion for a very long time. it's a really good way of organizing internal wikis and information. Those are a lot of advanced functionality in Notion that most people don't take advantage of, using things like databases and filter views. I think it's an incredibly underutilized tool for scaling information.
And do you use that on a personal basis too? Like, it sounds like you're quite a reflective sort of dude. I've seen some of your writing as well. So how do you use that in your own personal life as well?
Yeah, a little bit. For me, there's not much of a distinction between personal life and work life. So,
yeah, fair enough. Yeah, it's all blurred into one right now. That makes sense. Yeah, I definitely think, and they've got a lot of, you know, kind of templates you can use. I will also give a plug to one of my clients is actually a coder, which is it's kind of like an Airtable Notion hybrid. You can kind of, a lot of teams use it actually. Personally, even though I'm, you know, semi-biased towards them, I do think Notion is great for the personal use case. I've seen a lot of great teams use it. But Coda on the kind of collaboration side, they do a pretty good job of adding that functionality. The last thing to wrap us up, man, is just kind of very forward looking beyond your company, because obviously you're very close to all the kind of latest and greatest stuff going on in the world of tech, and specifically in healthcare, and how people are going to be using technology to manage their health. So I'm just curious, like a very open-ended question, what are the most exciting things you're seeing out there beyond your own company, and what do you think the future might hold for a lot of this kind of developments?
I think one of the interesting developments specifically within healthcare is the progress and development we've seen with the underlying infrastructure and platform layer. So companies like Truepill are maybe a good example of, they're building a lot of the infrastructure, kind of like AWS did for software companies, of things that used to take every startup $500,000 and a year to set up is now an off-the-shelf solution.
Oh, wow. What does Truepill do? I don't actually know much about them.
So they're a pharmacy distribution partner. They also have an EHR. They have a lot of the underlying infrastructure that you need to build a telemedicine company. Things that used to be really complicated, you can now use it as an off-the-shelf solution.
So just as it relates to what you guys do, I remember when I signed up, I get kind of paired with a GP or some sort of doctor. Is that using one of their...
That's services? All through Truepill now.
Yep. Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Yep. Okay. We had to set it up ourselves initially, and then we've been able to offload a lot of that work to Truepill.
Very cool. So do you think just those sort of companies allow for more experimental... You know, like, you know, what you guys are doing, the MVP version of it now would be a lot easier to spin up.
Totally. Yeah, I expect we'll see a proliferation of health tech companies that can take advantage of it. It's sort of like for people who were programmers 10 plus years ago, every new project you worked on, you had to dedicate multiple weeks to like handling payments. And then Stripe comes along and now it's trivial. And so this is like a thing that every programmer had to do for every project, and it was a huge pain. And now it's like a trivial integration. It takes like
Stripe
a couple hours.
Stripe, right?
Yeah. That's right.
That's amazing. Yeah. And just what the only other one I wanted to bring up is, again, not necessarily health related, but like Neuralink, I'm sure you've seen it. What Elon Musk and, well, he's not necessarily working on it every day, but the team there. I had Tim Urban on the show, and he talked about the how do you describe it? A brain machine?
Brain computer interface.
That's exactly, yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious, for something like that, like if, let's say 10 years from now, people were actually using that, maybe even before then, how do you think someone like yourself building levels could interact with a computer like that? What are the kind of things I might not have thought about that you might have thought about?
Yeah. Brain computer interfaces are a really interesting one. The information bandwidth question, I think, still very much remains to be seen on how feasible it is. I've talked to Max Hodak about some of this. There's still a very long way to go to figure out just how to get quality information out of the brain in a way that interfaces with a computer. Getting information into the brain, this is like the Matrix example of like downloading Kung Fu into your brain. That's probably an extremely far off future. So yeah, it's the brain is a very messy, complex system. So we'll see how long that one takes.
But yeah, I guess I'll stick to my Duolingo learning Spanish for now. Then it's not downloaded just yet. That's really cool, man. Well, listen, dude, I know you've got a lot going on, and I really appreciate you taking so much time. Thanks again for coming on the show. Was there anything else we didn't get to cover off you'd like to share with people listening?
No, I think we covered a lot of it. I think this is an interesting phase in company life cycle around 50 people. So there are other founders that have thoughts on how to navigate decision-making and organizational design. I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah, awesome, man. Yeah, and where could people find you on the internet? Best place to get in touch with you?
Best place is just on Twitter, at Sam Korkos.
Awesome, man. Well, Sam, thanks again. Really cool what you guys have built. Really, really bullish on what you guys are doing, and I'm a happy user as well. So thanks for your team for all the support there. And actually, funny story, I did actually bump into, I was in Oaxaca recently in Mexico, and I went to an Airbnb experience, and I sat opposite someone who was on your customer service support team, who I didn't realize we were talking for an hour or so. And because I was wearing an Oura ring and a Fitbit, and then we started talking about wearables, and somehow I think I brought up Levels. I was like, oh, there's a company called Levels. And he was like, oh my God, I work there. That's crazy. We realized we had actually spoken before over email. So it was really, really cool.
That's wild.
But anyway, so yeah, really cool. Seem to have a good group of people there, and I'm rooting for you guys. And hopefully a lot more people can get access to this soon. And yeah, and if you're still here, thanks again. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. And I'll share all that good stuff in the show notes. And we have a lot more episodes coming for you in the new season. So we'll see you on the next one. Cheers, Sam. Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZaidi, BZAIDI, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. Helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.